This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Ayin Hara is the evil eye. Most superstitious concept on the surface. But upon a little bit deeper investigation, I think we're going to find that it's a very real concept. Usually you'll hear people saying canine horror when they say something or do something which could arouse the jealousy of others. And they say canine horror. How many children have you got? 25 canine horror. I have some relatives that pronounce it differently. Canine horror. That's how most people pronounce it. They don't know what it means. It means canine horror. There should not be an ayin hara. I'm referring, of course, to Parshat Shkalim, which we read today. Today is a special Shabbos. It starts the sequence of Shabbatot prior to Pesach, where each Shabbos we read a special parsha in addition to the parsha of the week. The first of them is the Shabbos preceding Rosh Chodesh Adar. Rosh Chodesh Adar falls tonight and tomorrow and Monday. Today was the Shabbat Mevarchim. It was the day that preceded the Shabbos that preceded Rosh Chodesh Adar. And we read Parshas Shkolim. Parshas Shkolim is the little parsha at the beginning of Kitisa in Shemot chapter 30 verse 11, where God instructs Moshe that when he counts the people, he should count them not by counting their heads, but by asking each one to donate half a shekel to the Beit HaMikdash. And then if you count the half shekels, take the total number of shekels you've achieved and multiply by two, you will strangely enough get the right number. And that's the way to count the people. And the Torah says a strange thing in this instruction. The Torah says in verse 12, chapter 30 verse 12, V'lo yeyeh vohem negef bifkodoy som. And if you do it this way, then there will not be a plague when you count them. Now you've surely often said not three, not four. Right? They don't say one, two, three, four. This is the source of it. You don't count people. We see that when Moshe was instructed to count the people, he was told how to do it. The means of doing it was by each one donating the shekel and counting up the shkolim instead of counting up the people. And if you do that, says God, plague won't come. Which on the surface sounds very superstitious. To confirm the superstitious sound of the concept, we have a Rashi that says the following, and the whole shiur will be devoted to explaining this one Rashi. V'lo yiyeh vahem negef, and there will not be a plague, shehaminyan sholet bo ayin hara. Because when you count something, the ayin hara can affect it. V'hadever bo aleihem. And then wild animals can come and eat you up. Kemo shematzinu bimei David. As in fact we found in the days of David. Here the Rashi is referring to an episode in Shmuel Bet, chapter 24, where briefly it says that David instructed his general Yoav, Leich menei et Yisrael ve'et Yehuda. Go and count the Jews of Yisrael and Yehuda. Vayomer ha-melech el Yoav, and the king says to Yoav, go out all over and count. Vayomer Yoav el ha-melech, and Yoav says to the king, ve'yosef Hashem elokecha el ha'am kahem v'chahem mea po'amim. God will add to the people that are under you, King David, hundreds of times. V'einei Aduni HaMelech royos, and the eyes of my master the king can see that there are many people following. V'Aduni HaMelech lama chofetz b'dover hazeh. Why do you want to count them? Do you think people are emigrating? What is your problem? You can see the canine horror. You go, tell them the back door still open if they want to come in. That you can go, but More people, what more can you possibly want that you still need to count the people as you've got them? And the words of the king were strengthened to Yoav al-Sarei Achayil and to his soldiers and so on, and they were instructed to go. And they did this. Vayach lev David oiso acharei chen sofar esa'on. And David's heart hurt him after he'd counted the people. Vayomer David el Hashem, and God's, and David said to God, Chatosi me'oid asher asiti, I've done a terrible sin by counting the people. Ve'ato Hashem, haver nois oven avdecho ki niskalti me'oid. And now Hashem, please pass over the sin of your servant, because I've made a terrible mistake, I've been terribly foolish. And God comes to Gad the Novi, and he tells Gad to go and tell David the following. You've got a choice of one of three things, says Gad. Either 7 years of famine, or 3 months of war, or 3 days of wild animals running wild in your country. Which do you want? One of the three is your punishment. 3 days. 7 years, 3 months, or 3 days. Vayomer David el Gad, and here comes the famous sentence of the beginning of the Tachanun that we say every morning and every afternoon. And David says to Gad, you're putting me into a situation of unbelievable tsar, of unbelievable pain and anguish. David thinks a moment and he says, Niplo no biyad Hashem ki rabim rachamot. I opt to fall in the hands of God because He's merciful. Uviyad odom ale poilo, but let me not fall into the hands of another human being. So no famine, because then we rely on human beings. We rely on foreign countries to give us our food. No war, because then we rely on our allies, rather the wild animals, because then there are no human beings involved. It's the wild animals who are controlled by the Ribbono Shel Olam. If I have to suffer one of the three options, rather put me in the hands of God than in the hands of man. And he opts for the wild animals. That's what Rashi is referring to here, where he says that when you count, Sholet bo ayin hara, the ayin hara affects you, v'hadever bo aleihim, and wild animals come and they consume you. K'mo shemotzinu bimei David, as we find in the days of David. Now there are various questions here. The first question is, what is an ayin hara? Just to try and understand the concept of an ayin hara. The most important aspect that we have to try and explain in ayin hara, and this I've never done with you before, is to explain, what did I do wrong? If somebody else is jealous of me and gives me an ayin hara, the Gemara says, Ein misa beloy ovon, there's no beloy chet, there's no death without sin. If you suffer, you've done something wrong. Ayin hara is a kind of concept that you can give me an ayin hara, whatever that means, we'll still establish. But even if I've done nothing wrong, I suffer as a result of that. That's not just. So that's the main philosophic problem with the concept of ayin hara. Firstly, just to conceive of what ayin hara means. What is it? Is it a superstition or is it something real? It appears to be something real because Rashi talks about it. And secondly, if it's something real, how does it work? That I can suffer although I've done nothing wrong. Furthermore, what does Rashi say? Before the other questions. One second question that I will put at this point is his quote from Dovid. This is the Ramban asks this question. And he says, so what's the way that you avoid the ayin hara coming onto you? By counting not the heads, but by counting something which they all handed. So do you want to say that Dovid HaMelech, King David, counted them the wrong way? Surely he would have known this did. Surely Dovid HaMelech knew his chumash, and he knew that this is the way you're supposed to count. How can we say that Dovid HaMelech counted them without taking in the shekels, that he counted some other way? The Rabbeinu Bechaya, to try and explain this piece of chumash, brings the following Gemara. This is a Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Membet Amud Aleph, 42a. Tanu Rabbonin, we learnt in a brisa. Ha-hoylech lomud eskoirona. If a person is going to measure his silos, he's had a year of farming, he's brought in his produce, and he's stocked them away in his storerooms. And he's now going out to weigh it all up, to see how much he's got. Oymer, he says before he goes, Yehi rotzon milafonecho Hashem Elokeinu, may it be thy will, ribcho b'maase yodeinu, that you should send blessing in the work of our hands. Hitchil lomud, if he has already started to measure and to weigh, Omer, he says, Baruch HaSholeach Brocho Bekeri Hazeh. Blessed be he who sends bracha, who sends blessing into the store of tavua of wheat, produce. Modad v'achakach birech. But if you first measure, weigh up, and then make the bracha, hareze tefillah shav. That's a wasted tefillah. Lefisha ein habracha metzuya loy bedover hashoku v'loy bedover hamodud v'loy bedover hamonu. Because there cannot be bracha in something which has been weighed, measured, or counted. Once you've measured your produce, once you know how much is there, there cannot be any bracha anymore. So to pray to God that He should bless your produce, it's too late once you've measured it. Ela bedover hatsomui min ha'ayin. Only with something which is hidden from the eye. Something which is not defined. Which means don't check your bank balance. And if you want the Ribbono Shel Olam to bless your bank balance, leave it alone. Just leave it. And this is paskin din halacha. This is paskin both in the Rambam and in the Shulchan Aruch as the din. Explains Rabbeinu Bechaya. Rabbeinu Bechaya explains this Gemara in the following way. He says very simply, to be deserving of a nes nistar, of an indirect miracle, of a miracle which is not obvious. That's something which happens all the time. The fact that we're alive, the fact that we get around, the fact that we do what we do, the fact that we survive, is all a nice nista, that's all a miracle. But it's a hidden miracle, it's not an obvious miracle. An obvious miracle is like splitting the Red Sea, or one of these things. That's very difficult and very unusual that anybody has sufficient schus, sufficient merit, to deserve an obvious dramatic miracle. Therefore, says Rabbeinu Bechaya very simply, once you've measured and you know how much you've got, if God multiplies that by two, that's an open miracle. It's a closed miracle, it's a behind the scenes miracle, if you don't know quite how much you've got. It's about 1,000 rand, you think, and you come and it's 1,500. So maybe you made a mistake. And it happens next month the same, and the next month the same. One begins to see that you didn't make a mistake, but it's not a nice goli. Nobody can see for clear that this is an obvious miracle. Therefore, says Rabbeinu Bechaya, one doesn't count. You don't quantify things, because to quantify things limits them. Once you've quantified it, there can be no bracha, there can be no blessing. And therefore, you don't count people, because you're quantifying them, and once you've quantified them, there can't be a blessing. I have one very simple question on Rabbeinu Bechaya. If that's the case, what does it help to count them with the shkolim? You still know how many people there were, exactly. And what is the difference if you count them 1, 2, 3, or you count up the shkolim? The fact is that at the end of it, you know how many people there are, and the next day they double the amount of people. That's brocha, that's a miracle. So one doesn't understand clearly how Rabbeinu Bechaya explains the piece of Chumash, but we'll come back to it. I want to bring you another Gemara. Rabbi Yochanan was a very beautiful man. He was a man who was incredibly handsome and good-looking. And the Gemara tells us in Brochas Daf Kaf Amud Aleph, page 20a, that Rabbi Yochanan hava ragil dehava ka'azil v'yativ ash'ari d'tvila. Rabbi Yochanan used to have the custom, strangely enough, of going and sitting in the evening time at the gates to the mikveh. When ladies used to come and use the mikveh in the evenings, Rabbi Yochanan used to stand nearby. Very strange thing. It's not something precedented, and it's not something which is recommended, but that's what he did. Omar, he used to say, "Ki salkon benois Yisrael va'atyon mitzvilo." When the daughters of Israel come out of the mikveh from the tzvilo, mistaklon bi, they look at me, v'nahavi luhu zaro deshviri kevasi. And they have children as handsome as me. That's just his little thing. Obviously, he took it from the story of Yaakov and the sheep, that by putting those mottled things at the bottom of the troughs, you remember, the sheep bore mottled little ones. And he felt the same would apply. There seems to be something to it in Chazal, that if a woman is surrounded, or a man maybe too, but if a parent is surrounded by beauty, that affects their relationship with their wife,
that with their husbands, and that affects the whole relationship of their love, which in turn affects the caliber of the child. A child conceived in love and beauty is not the same as a child conceived in depression, resentfulness, and so on. Omri le Rabbonin. So the Rabbonin used to say to him, Loiko mistafi marma eino bisho. Aren't you worried about ayin hara? The women come out and they see you, beautiful Rabbi Yochanan, and you're much more beautiful than their husbands, and you're much more beautiful than their children. Aren't you worried that they're going to give you an ayin hara? That they're going to look at you jealously? That they're going to look at you resentfully? What did you do to deserve such good looks? And that can harm you? So we see that ayin hara is not only referred to in Rashi, it's referred to in the Gemara already. So this is no superstition, this is for real. Amar lehu, he said to them, Anu mizara de Yosef ka'atina. No, he says, I come from the tribe of Yosef. I'm a descendant of Joseph. The lo shalta ba'in abisha, don't you know that ayin hara doesn't work with us Josephites? Dichtiv, as it says, ben porat Yosef, ben porat alei ayin, the children of the fruit of Yosef, or the children of Yosef, the children of alei ayin v'amri Rabbi Yavo al tikra alei ayin ela oyle ayin, the children of he who transcends the eye, meaning the ayin hara. V'bayis ema, the Gemara gives various other explanations, and the other one which we'll deal with is ayin sheloi rotzta lozun mimoshe eino sheloi. That eye which wanted no benefit from what was not his, going back to the story of Potiphar's wife and Yosef, that eye of Yosef that wanted no benefit from somebody who wasn't his, and he said, you'll remember, how can I do this after all? You belong to my master, Potiphar, and he's entrusted everything to me, and how can I let him down? I don't want anything to do with you. That eye that didn't want anything that wasn't his, ein ayin hara shaletes bo. Ayin hara doesn't affect. This is the first time we see that there is a relationship between my actions and whether ayin hara affects me or not. So we see, we don't understand it yet, but we'll understand it soon. But what we see at this point already is that ayin hara is not something beyond my control. That the children of Yosef are not affected by ayin hara because Yosef never desired something that wasn't his. So there's already a concept here. One more Gemara. The Gemara says in Psochim Daf Nun Amud Beis 50b, Tanu Rabbonin, we learnt in a Braisa, Tagre Simto, people who work in the stock exchange, that's on the floor of the stock exchange, in public, Umagadle Behemo Dako, and shepherds of sheep, Bekoitzetze Ilonos Toivos, and people who chop down good trees to use for wood, V'noisnin Einehem Bechelek Yofe, and I'm mainly interested in this last one here, V'noisnin Einehem Bechelek Yofe, and people who, when you offer them two pieces of cake, take the nicer piece, Eino roye siman brocha lo'olam. They will never ever see blessing, brocha. My timer, why? The tahu bei inshi, because people resent them. Incredible Gemara. We won't go into the others, because it's all the same principle. But a man who, when you offer him two pieces of cake on a plate, takes the bigger one, is a man who will never see brocha because people resent him. Let's understand this. I come along, I've got two pieces of cake on the plate, one for you and one for me. And I offer the cake to you first. If I wanted the bigger one, I would have taken it first. So I obviously would like you to choose whichever one you want, preferably the bigger one. Yet, if you're the kind of person who takes the bigger one, says the Gemara, you'll never see a sign of brocha. That's a kind of man who's not capable of having blessing. Why not? There was an Israeli here a little while ago who came back. He was actually a Rosh Hashiva who just wasn't familiar with Western custom. And he went to have dinner at some people, and he came back from dinner very, very distraught and worried. He says, I don't know what I did wrong. I was very hungry. He says, I haven't eaten for a long time, and I was very grateful for the invitation to have a meal. And they gave a first course, which was hors d'oeuvres, a little piece of chopped liver. It was very nice, but a small piece. And afterwards they said, would anybody like some more? And I said, yes, please. And after I'd had some more, they again said, would you like some more? And I said, yes, please. I didn't know if there was anything more to eat. And he said, I did it 4 times, and suddenly there was an atmosphere around the table that I realized I was doing something wrong. He says, please explain to me. He says, when people say, would you like some more, is it that they don't mean it? Is it that they expect you to say no? And I said, yes. And I brought out this Gemara. You offer a person a large piece of cake and a small piece of cake. You're offering it to him to take whichever one he wants. But if he takes the large piece of one, you say, you chaza. That's how it is. Why? Because when you go to eat with somebody, when you go to a meal, you don't go to eat. You eat at home. If you want to eat, you don't go to fill your stomach. You go for the social experience of sitting around the table and eating with people. And therefore, when people say, would you like some more, which is the polite and courteous thing for any host to say, if you say, yes, please, what you're saying is, I've come here to fill my stomach and my stomach isn't full yet. It's necessary for you to say, in terms of courtesy, no, thank you. It's not just Western crazy politeness. This is Musa. This is Torah. It's necessary for the host to offer. And it's necessary for the guest to say, thank you very much, that was delicious, but I've had enough. And if he's hungry, he goes home and he eats at home. Because you didn't come. The hospitality was not to shove food down your face, because then the host could have sent food to your house. He could have sent you a parcel at home. The fact that he invites you to his home is because he wants the pleasure of your company at his table, not because he wants to feed your face. And when's the time that people sit around together and have an opportunity to be social around the meal? Ain't simcha below achilu v'shtiyo. There's no simcha without food and drink. But that doesn't mean that you have to be gluttonous. The food and drink is the oil for the social relationships. You're doing something together, you're sitting around the table, but it's not there for everybody to cram themselves. That's not the purpose of a social meal. There are meals where you go to eat, and there are meals where you go for social reasons. And when it's for social reasons, it's a different thing altogether. Let's look at the man now with the 2 pieces of cake. If I take the smaller piece of cake, what am I saying really? I'm really demonstrating by my action. What I'm saying is, thank you very much for offering the cake. I understand that by offering me the cake, you would like some cake too. Won't you take the bigger piece? I don't really need the cake, but I'll join you. To be polite, I'll join you. So I'll take the smaller one. That's what you're saying. That's so refined. That's so beautiful. A man's offering you cake, and what you're basically saying, I'm offering you cake because I think you're hungry. And you are answering to me, you know, I really don't need any cake, thank you very much, but I would love to join you eating the cake. But for that, I only need a small piece. I don't need the bigger one. What do you mean if you're taking the bigger one? Thank you very much, I'm dying for some. That's what you mean. And if I could take 2 pieces of cake, I would take them both. But that obviously wouldn't be polite, so I'll suffice with the bigger one. That's what it is. But do you see what refinement one's talking about? Do you see what a quality of interpersonal relationship one's talking about? And this isn't Western politeness. This is Torah. A man who takes the bigger piece when he's offered it, Einoi roye siman brocha loilu, must never expect brocha. Why? Says the Gemara, the tohu be'u imshi, because people are resentful. Why are they resentful? Because the feeling inside me, the host, must be that if you're taking the bigger one, it means what's important to you is how much you've got. Not how tasty the food is. Not how the effort that's gone into the cake. You're not eating just as an expression of gratitude and an expression of appreciation because you think it might be taken amiss if you refuse it. You're eating because you want lots. That's why you're eating. I must feel threatened. I must feel that, you know, if I don't give you more and more and more, you'll go into my kitchen and empty my fridge. I must feel that I'm in danger here. That this man has come to take what I've got. I offer him something as a courtesy and he grabs it as a right. I must feel threatened. And I must feel resentful. Why? Because one can take pleasure. Just before I come onto this, I want to use this Gemara now to explain that previous one. When the Gemara says about the children of Yosef, an eye that has never wanted anything that isn't his. The ayin hara doesn't work with it. Ayin hara is resentment. When do I feel resentment? Is when I feel that you resent what I've got. Because the guy who takes the big piece of cake is basically saying, I would like them both. But since that wouldn't be polite, suffice it to take the larger one. That means he wants what's mine, really. Because if he was a mensch, he should regard the bigger piece of cake as mine. The fact that he has the chutzpah to take the biggest piece of cake, although I offered it to him, shows that what he wants is what I've got. And he resents what I've got, and he wants what I've got. Really, a person should be embarrassed to take something which he's given. Soine matonis yichye. A man who despises gifts. He feels uncomfortable when he's given something. Yichye, that's a living man. That's a man who has brocha, that's a man who can live. But a man who loves to take things which he's given, that's a man who's not yichye, that's an empty pit that you're just pouring stuff into. And therefore, says Rabbi Yochanan, we children of Yosef don't have to worry. Because people never feel threatened by our presence. They never feel resentment towards us. Because they know that we have never ever wanted anything that isn't ours. And that comes across in our behavior. In the sense that, for example, if we, Bnei Yosef, are offered two pieces of cake, we'll take the smaller one. Nobody in our presence ever feels threatened. If we're at a business negotiation, the other party doesn't feel they're trying to consume me. They're trying to get me out of business. They're trying to take me over. Never ever is that the feeling. The feeling is always, these people don't want anything that isn't theirs. They're prepared to pay for whatever they take. To pay in money, to pay in kindness, to pay in response, to pay in effort, whatever it is. But with the Bnei Yosef, you never have the feeling. He's out to take. He's out to get. And even if I have pleasure in giving, that pleasure is spoilt when the taker has pleasure in taking. Let's look at it a little bit further. To want what isn't yours means you want more. The desire for more is the emotion that we're talking about here. One can get a certain pleasure from having things. But one can only sustain that pleasure by one of two ways. Either one has to show off what one's got, because to have something that nobody knows about is no pleasure. If I want pleasure from owning something, I'm talking now about only the pleasure of owning it. Not the pleasure of using it. Not the pleasure of enjoying it. I'm talking about the pleasure of owning it. That's a pleasure all on its own. If I want the pleasure of owning something, the only way that pleasure is significant to me is if other people can see that I've got it. Ostentation. In one form or another. Alternatively, the fact that I've got more than I had yesterday. So if I'm making a lot of money on the stock exchange, each day I'm making a new 10,000 rand, I don't have to go around telling everyone. The fact that yesterday I only had 100,000 rand, and today I've got 110,000 rand, and tomorrow I've got 120,000 rand, that gives me enough enjoyment. I don't have to talk about it. But if I made 50,000 rand on the stock exchange in one go, after a couple of weeks I have to talk about it. That's then it finishes. I've got no more. Then I've got to tell people, you know, made 50,000 rand on the stock exchange the other day. That feels good. There's got to be a degree of ostentation, or I must spend the money in a way that people can see that I've made it. When a man takes pleasure in numbers, when a man takes pleasure in the number of things he's got, whether it's money, whether it's food, whether it's property, whether it's pages of Gemara, whether it's mitzvahs, whether it's students, whatever it is, if a man's pleasure comes from the number of things he has, he's a threat to society. Because obviously he wants more. And a man who wants more is a man who's going to disturb other people. He's going to take things that aren't his. He's going to want things that aren't his. That's the desire to want more. To want something that isn't mine. That's the feeling with a fellow who takes the big piece of cake. That's a man who wants more, and if he wants more, he wants mine, because there's no more hefker. Nothing in this house is hefker, nothing in this house is ownerless. So if he wants more, he wants mine. And that's a feeling of being threatened. And it creates a feeling of resentment. A small, tiny feeling of resentment must exist in the one who's threatened by the one who wants more. Says the Gemara now in Bava Metzia, the first Gemara we started with, brocha is not found in something which is measured, because if you measure it, it's a sign that you're taking pleasure in how. If I add up my bank balance, not for any specific reason, we'll talk later on about specific reasons, but if I just go and I add up my bank balance, or I look in the newspaper, the stock market, I've got shares on the stock market, and every day I look and I count up how much I've got on the stock market. I've got to put some money on the stock market, and every time the paper comes out, I open the paper, and even if somebody's with me, that's just too bad. I open the paper, too bad for them. And the radio goes on, and so it goes on, adding up how much I've got all the time. Why am I doing that? Because of the pleasure of increasing my assets. And it is a pleasure. It's a quantitative pleasure of increasing assets. That's one kind of pleasure. Alternatively, there must be ostentation. Says the Gemara in Bava Metzia, if you measure something, if you weigh something, or if you count something, there's no more bracha. Because there's ayin hara. Once you've measured it and counted it, you're a quantitative person. And anybody else, other people, feel, as a result of that, there comes over the feeling, let's put it this way, the fact that you need to count your assets to enjoy them means that you're the kind of person who gets pleasure from owning. And if you're the kind of person that gets pleasure from owning, other people feel you as a threat. And if other people feel you as a threat, we learned in the Gemara in Pesachim, there's no bracha. If other people feel that you always want more, they will stand in the way of bracha. Bracha is something which God only gives if other people concur. If the general feeling in society is that this man should have more, that's when God allows bracha. But when there are people going around saying, why should he have it? What did he do to deserve it? Why is he any better than I? Then God gives that man his due, but no bracha, no blessing. And so says the Gemara. Once you've measured, counted, or weighed, that indicates that you're a man that doesn't get bracha. Because bracha is only found bedavar hasomui min ha'ayin, things which the eye can't see. There's no ostentation, and there's no measurement. You yourself don't know how much you've got. That's when there can be bracha. Somebody says, are you a millionaire? And you can answer faithfully and honestly, I don't know. I really don't know. Last I counted, it's irrelevant already when last I counted. I don't know if I'm a millionaire. I've got no idea. Then people will say to you, so what do you get your kick in life? Where's your ambition if you don't know if you're making money or losing money? And you say, what do I care? I'm enjoying myself and I've got money for what I need. Do I care if I'm a millionaire or not? People find that difficult to understand, but at least they don't feel threatened by you. They feel you're a man who's drawing in brocha, the money seems to become rolling in, but you're not going out destroying other people to get it. Because it's not that important for you to have more. How then do you enjoy your assets? If you don't enjoy it by measuring it and seeing that you've got more than you had yesterday. If you don't enjoy it by showing it off to others. What other means is there of enjoying business? There is another means. And that is, now I'm going to tie up two concepts that we discussed last week. The first one was Rav Shimon Shkop's definition of Kedusha. That Kedusha, holiness, the mitzvah of being holy, is the mitzvah of doing good to the community. But you've got to see that in all you do, the world benefits somehow. That's Kedusha. The second concept is the concept of value. How do you measure value? What is value? Can you measure value in terms of money? Do you measure value in terms of gold? You measure value in terms of the number of hours it takes to work to be able to earn the thing that you have now got. How does one measure value? One can measure value with a very simple scale. You determine what your ambition is. And when you've determined what your ambition is, you figure out how much does it cost you to get the article you want in terms of losing out for your ambition, and to what extent will the article you acquire help you in your ambition. So if your business is banking, let's say, and you've got to persuade people that you're a reliable banker and that they can leave their money with you and they don't need to worry about anything, then you say to yourself, in order to do that, I've got to buy a building in the middle of town. I've got to spend 4 million rand on a building. People have to know that that I have assets, that there's nothing to worry about. So I have to work like a slave to raise that 4 million rand so that I can own a building. That makes sense. I have to work terribly hard. But my aim and ambition is to be a banker, and I can't be a banker unless people have confidence in me. Therefore, the 3 years' work it's going to take me to buy my building is worthwhile, because my building will then be my means of becoming a banker. That's fine. You decide you're a teacher. And to be a teacher, you need an Encyclopedia Britannica. You figure out that means working so and so many hours overtime or giving so and so many private lessons so that I can afford an Encyclopedia Britannica. You don't ask yourself how much does an Encyclopedia Britannica cost. It becomes irrelevant. Whatever it costs in terms of effort is worthwhile because your ambition is to be a top teacher. And you've decided that in order to achieve that ambition, you need an Encyclopedia Britannica. And when you've got a situation like this, value exceeds cost. And when value exceeds cost, it's a good investment. In Torah, our ambition is Kedusha. But in everything we do, the world should benefit. And each person must find his own area in which he can benefit the world in terms of the talents that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given him. Different people have different talents. If you think that God's made you to be a doctor, then that's how you'll do good for the world. If God's made you to be a teacher, that's how you'll do it. If He's made you to have a good heart and do chesed, that's how you'll do it. Each person has to find what are the koichas, what are the powers and abilities that God has given to me, and how can I employ those abilities to benefit the world generally, on the widest scale possible, on the most effective level possible. Of course, in order to do that, it's necessary to know the world. You can't do good for the world unless you understand what the world is. For example, a man might say, my way of doing good for the world is to be a doctor. So I'm not going to learn any Torah, because my ambition is now to be a doctor, and if I have to spend time learning Torah, that will detract from my ambition. That's not correct. Because you'll come into the hospital, and you'll have to take a decision as to whether you turn off a respiratory machine or not. And then you'll realize that medicine has not equipped you enough to do good for the world. Is doing good for the world turning off the machine or leaving on the machine? If A and B need a machine and there's only one machine and I've got to choose who it is, do I choose A or do I choose B? Which is doing more good for the world? For that you need Torah. So there's no way one can try and do good for the world without being a Talmid Chacham. One has to be a Talmid Chacham, plus choose an area in which one's going to specialize in doing good for the world. It might be within Torah, it might be beyond Torah. That doesn't matter. But one has to be a Talmid Chacham, and doing good for the world. If that's the case, we mentioned last week that all one's assets, provided they are used as work tools, provided one uses one's assets and one's material belongings as a means to achieve that Kedusha, as a means of doing for the world, then there's bracha, then there's blessing and privilege in whatever assets you've got. That's something which the Ribbono Shel Olam will provide. If you want the assets for yourself because you want a bigger piece of cake, then God doesn't provide it. For that you've got to work yourself. But if you need certain tools in order to function as a giver in the world, that the Ribbono Shel Olam will provide you with. And therefore there's another way of enjoying material possessions. You don't have to enjoy the fact that you've got more than yesterday. You don't have to enjoy the fact that other people can see what you've got. You can enjoy the increased potency achieved by your new possession. Whereas before you didn't have a private aeroplane, and now you've got a private aeroplane, that means you can now go around to all the surrounding communities and spend the Shabbos in each community and teach them Torah. Power I've got. Potency. My Kedusha was restricted without that little aeroplane before. Now my Kedusha is unrestricted. Look what I can do for the world now. No pleasure in the aeroplane for itself. No pleasure that anybody else should even know that it's mine. The pleasure is in the increased power. The fact that I'm now more useful, that I can achieve greater levels of Kedusha, because I have more tools to enable me to do more for the world. That's a different way of enjoying material things. And so it is even in Torah. One kind of pleasure of learning, which unfortunately is all too frequent, is how many shiurim I go to, how many daf of Gemara I've learned, the fact that I know something today which I didn't know yesterday. You know, that's all irrelevant. It makes no difference how many shiurim you go to. It makes no difference how much or how little you know, and it makes no difference if you know something which you didn't know yesterday. What's important is not what I've got from Torah. That's not important. I've got a new piece of knowledge, a new piece of information, a new perek of Gemara. That's not what's important. What's important is that I have an increased ability to do and understand as a result of my Torah. And that might come from revising the same piece of Gemara. It might come from learning a new piece of Gemara. It can come from anything. But what's important is not what I've got out of my learning, but what I'm able to achieve as a result of my learning. And if I've learned 10 mesechtas this year, but I can't do any more with them than I could do with my one Masechta last year. What have I done? So I've collected some more facts. Who needs the facts? What's their purpose? My aim and ambition is Kedusha. My aim and ambition is to do more for the world. For that I need to learn more so that I can understand the world better. But if I've learnt more and I don't understand the world any better, what am I learning? Where's it all going? Those are the two types of people. People who enjoy numbers and people who enjoy the increased potency that results from new tools. If you have to measure your money, if you have to define it and count it up in order to get pleasure, if you have to count up the number of pages you've learned, if you have to count up the number of Talmidim that you have, or the number of friends that you have, if you have to count up whatever it is, then your pleasure is coming from numbers. And that's a person who will never see bracha, because he's a threat to society and people resent him. He's out for more and more and more. And more is always at the expense of somebody else. But if you're a kind of person, it makes no difference how much I've got. What's important is how much I can do with what I've got. And having more is only a means of doing more. Then I'm a different person altogether. So let's go back to the example of the cake. Assuming that I say to you, I come to your house and I say, look, we're going to learn through the night tonight. Sit down with you and we're going to go through the Gemara. We're starting at 7 o'clock this evening and we go right through till 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. And we're learning and learning and learning and we're terribly hungry at 1 o'clock in the morning. And you bring me two pieces of cake, a smaller one and a larger. Assuming I take the larger one. And immediately upon finishing the larger piece of cake and saying my bracha achrona, we go back to the learning. Do you resent it then? No. So I've taken the larger piece of cake. So what? Why? Because I need more. Why do I need more? Because I'm hungry. And what do I do now that I've got more? I give it back to you. I sit and I learn with you. That doesn't cause resentment if there's that kind of give and take. In other words, if I'm taking more, but the world benefits from my taking more, that doesn't matter. If I'm making more and more money and the world is benefiting more and more, the more money I'm making, who cares? Nobody feels threatened. That won't result in a lack of bracha. What will result in a lack of bracha is if every night before I go to bed, I count up how much I've got. Ah, it was a good day today. Why was it a good day today? Because I made an extra 1,000. Or I learnt an extra piece of Gemara. What's so good about that? There's nothing good. I've got an extra 1,000 so I can help another Jew. Or I've learnt a new piece of Gemara, which means I can approach ABC in a completely different way now. And I can be far more effective in what I'm doing. That, yes, that's a completely different thing. When the Torah comes to the Parsha of Shekolim, what God instructs Moshe is a very simple thing. He says to Moshe, when you count the people, don't count the people. Count their contributions. That's what's important. Count what they give, because it's irrelevant how many you've got. What's important is the sum total of their donations. What's important is the sum total of their contributions. And although for the sake of counting you standardize the contributions, there's a message here. There's a message here that Moshe is not interested in knowing how many people he's got. Moshe is interested in knowing what power he's got. How many people are behind him? How many people are contributing? To say there's 70 people at the shul tonight, or 80 or 50 or whatever it is, power, fantastic. It's irrelevant. What's important is how many people are there at the shul that understand, that respond, that are going to revise and do what they've learned and carry it out and live it. You can have 100 people sitting at a shiur and 2 people who are going to respond. That's much worse than having 4 people at the shiur and 4 people responding. The second way you have a 100% success rate, and the first way you have a 2% success rate. What's the comparison? It's just not important how many people. It's not important how many things. All that's important is what can result out of the many. And what we're told here is, Moshe, count the people, but don't count them. Don't let them think that it's important to you how many people you've got. They must know that what's important to you is the contribution they're making. That's what you're counting. And lastly, comes the question, what about David HaMelech? So did he, as Rashi says, count them wrong? Did he count them without taking the shekolim? Did he count their heads? Says the Ramban, no, this is a Ramban in Bamidbar. Listen to the words, you'll hear the whole shiur in the Ramban.
This is in the first chapter of Bamidbar, right in the beginning, verse 3, says the Ramban the following.
Aval kafi dati, but it is my belief. Haya haketzef alav, God got angry with King David. Ba'avur shemena'am shelo letzorech, because he counted them unnecessarily. He used the shekolim, but he didn't use the message and the principle of the shekolim. The shekolim is not just a method of counting. You don't need that method of counting. There are many methods of counting. The shekolim is a principle in ethics. Teach people that when you count, you're not interested in how many, you're interested in how much contribution. And David counted them without any reason. Why did he do it? Ki lo haya yotzei lemilchama. He wasn't about to go out to war. Of course you're allowed to count your bank balance if somebody's there for a check for tzedakah and you don't know whether you have enough to give him. Of course you can count to figure out how much to give him. If you want to buy your wife a diamond ring and you don't know whether you can afford it or not, of course it would be silly to go out and buy it and say the Gemara says you mustn't count your money. When there's a reason to count, you count, but not as an end in itself. David, says the Ramban, was not going out to war. V'loy oise bohem dovo ba'esahi, and he wasn't using his people for any particular project at that time. Rak l'sameach liboy shemoloch al am rav, just to gladden his heart that he was a king of so many people. That's what he was doing it for. V'hu ma'amar Yoav, and that's what Yoav answers him. V'yosef Hashem elokecho al am bohem v'chohem mea po'omim v'adoni ha'melech lama chofetz b'dover hazeh. When Yoav says to King David, the Ramban explains what he means. David HaMelech, what do you have to count the people for? You want the Nachas to know how many people are following you. Can't you see? Can't you see the thousands and thousands of people? And in years to come there will be more people. What do you need to count them for? Isn't it obvious to you? And David insists on counting them, says the Ramban, not because he needed to count them for any reason, just the pleasure of knowing how many people there were. Difficult to understand this, that David needed that kind of pleasure, but we won't go into explaining that. The fact is that Ramban is criticizing David on this level, that he derived a certain pleasure from knowing how a king of how big a nation he was. V'ra'isi b'midbar Sinai Rabbo. And says the Ramban, don't think this is mine. I gave you a shir and I said, don't think it's mine, it's the Ramban's. And the Ramban says, don't think this is mine, I saw it in the Medrash. Where Rabbi Eliezer b'shem Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra Omer. Rabbi Lezer, in the name of Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra, said, Kol zman shenimnu Yisrael letzorech, whenever the Jews were counted for a need, loy chosru, nobody was lacking, nobody was missing. Sheloy letzorech, when they were counted without a need, why then were they counted? Just for pleasure, for fun? Chosru, there were people missing. Ezez man nimnu letzorech, when were they counted for a need? Bimei Moshe. When Moshe counted them, they were being counted for a need to measure their contribution. And when they were dividing out the land, sheloy letzorech, when was their counting unnecessarily? Says the Medrash, bimei David. In the time of David, there was unnecessary counting. And here says the Ramban, you have the whole principle. When you count something for no reason, that means you're taking pleasure in numbers. When you're taking pleasure in numbers, there's ayin hara. Because if you take pleasure in numbers, you're a threat to everybody else. If you take pleasure in 100, you'll want 200. And if you've got 200, you'll want 1,000. And if you've got 1,000, you'll want 10,000. And where are you going to get that from? You're going to have to take that from somebody else. And that causes resentment. And that one isn't allowed. That causes ayin hara. And as a result of ayin hara, there's no brocha. And now the Rashi makes perfect sense. Shehaminyan sholeit bo ayin hara. When you count something without a reason, just for the fun of knowing how much you've got, then there's ayin hara, there's going to be somebody who resents you because you're a quantity man. You're a man who plays the numbers game. And the numbers game is always played at somebody else's expense. Bahadever bo'aleihem, and pestilence come as a result of that. Kemo shematzinu bimei David, as we found with David. Therefore count them with shekolim. Not because, as we asked on Rabbeinu Bechaya, it makes any difference. If you count with shekolim, you'll still know how many people there are. But it demonstrates that your interest is not in how much you've got, but in what you can achieve with what you've got.